From the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, this is Audiophiles. I'm your host, Adam Warner. Today, Audiophiles is diving into the world of art and science. We're not talking about biology 101. This is real people using creativity and ingenuity to explore the world.
Well, I've always thought the universe is hilarious, just for starters. And in my life experience, people learn much more when they're enjoying themselves, when you can get them to laugh.
We'll travel all the way to Antarctica with a team of British scientists who are on the hunt for life.
At the moment, there's absolutely nothing out there whatsoever. So I need to look at my map, check my coordinates, get the GPS programmed up, and then go on a little trek out into the middle of essentially nowhere and put a flag in the ground.
We'll also learn about artists making the best of some of the most polluted sites in New York State.
It is still beautiful, you know, as a body of water, despite all the horror stories.
Plus, the band Slack Tie joins us live in the studio. But first, here's the news.
Good evening, New York. This is your daily news digest. I'm Willis Arnold. As we close in on the fiscal cliff, tensions between Democrats and Republicans continue to escalate. The sticking point, as usual, is tax cuts. The president favors a plan that would extend tax cuts to the majority of Americans, but increase taxes on America's wealthiest 2%. Although Republicans historically challenged this plan, today House Republicans were split over the issue. House Speaker John Boehner shot down Republican Representative Tom Cole's call to approve the measure. In world news today, problems continue to plague the Middle East. The ceasefire holds in Gaza, but a bombing in nearby Syria claimed 34 lives. The Syrian state news agency called it a terrorist attack. This is yet another example of violence during the 20-month-long civil war that's ravaged the nation since President Bashar al-Assad was deposed. Stateside, a recent study indicates that ADHD medication may indeed help curb crime. The study appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine. The study's authors say that impulse control, enhanced by these drugs, can lead to less violent behavior. Less violent behavior leads to less crime. The full implications of this study are not yet realized, but it may indicate a new way to address antisocial behavior. Finally, perhaps Angus T. Jones should have exercised a little impulse control this week. On Monday, the star of TV's Two and a Half Men called for people to stop watching his show. He characterized it as filth. Today, he apologized for his comment and for offending anyone who works on the show. For Audiophiles, I'm Willis Arnold.
Science can be a dense, overwhelming, strange, and sometimes boring topic. But science has found a new friend, comedy. From podcasts to live shows, programs that mix science and humor are becoming a big hit. Daisy Rosario has the story.
This evening, the topic will be the exploration of the solar system.
On a recent Friday night in Brooklyn, an audience of about 350 people packed into the Bell House, a music, comedy, and dance venue in Gowanus. The topic? The exploration of the solar system. The special guest? Astrobiologist Dr. David Grinspoon.
I've worked all kinds of houses. I've been in front of audiences that are, you know, a third full and very polite and sedate and interested. And that's fun, in a different way. You know, I wouldn't want to stop doing that because you can get into the material in a deeper way and provoke discussion and so forth. But it is very gratifying to have a full house of people that are just really enthralled. And, you know, I'm not so deluded to think that I was the reason they were where they were enthralled, but at least part of it was what I was there to talk about. The fact the Mars rover itself got a big cheer.
Get ready to do science parties.
Grinspoon is just one of many scientists being invited to take part in this newfound appreciation of science as popular entertainment. Leading the brigade is Neil deGrasse Tyson, host of Star Talk, a radio show, podcast, and stage show devoted to all things space.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson. I'm an astrophysicist with the American Museum of Natural History.
He also makes the pop culture rounds as a frequent guest on HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher and on Nova Science Now on PBS. He started StarTalk in 2009 to, as he says, make the universe accessible. The live show followed in 2011.
In the first of the live shows that we did, who knows what StarTalk is, right? It was a little bit unfamiliar, a little bit odd. Would you commit your Friday night and spend the ticket money to go hear anything about science?
But people are doing just that. Every StarTalk live show has sold out, usually in a few days. This last show sold out in under 2 hours. Tyson says the humor is key. He is naturally pretty funny himself, and StarTalk has always been co-hosted by comedians.
Well, I've always thought the universe is hilarious, just for starters. And in my life experience, people learn much more when they're enjoying themselves, when you can get them to laugh. And so what the comedian does, it gets us across some of the spots of science that could use some levity, because, of course, so much of the universe is full of gravity.
Now, a number of smaller shows are popping up. One of the most popular is Nerd Night.
So Nerd Night is a monthly gathering in bars and performance venues across the globe in which usually experts give funny yet smart presentations while the audience drinks as much as possible.
That's Matt Wazowski, the overlord of Nerd Night in New York City.
One of the alternate taglines of Nerd Night is, it's like the Discovery Channel with beer. And we emphasize the drinking because ultimately you're at a bar, you're with friends, you're on it's a Friday night in a large city, and you want to have fun. And so sometimes we'll do theme nights. For example, in November of this year, we'll have November Butt Night. I'll have mostly scientific talks, actually, about how the rectum and anus have play very important roles in people's lives.
Even with the funny topics, the stars of the night are the scientists. They're the real deal.
So our presenters are generally, for the most part, despite the ridiculous sounding nature of many of the presentations, are actually our PhDs or really kind of the best in their fields. And we just try to obviously present them humorously.
Thanks to its online growth, you can even put nerd entertainment in your pocket. Take Nerdist, for example. It's a podcast started by stand-up comic Chris Hardwick in 2010. In only 2 years, it has grown into what Hardwick calls his Nerdist empire. The podcast is consistently in the iTunes top 10. For Hardwick, there's a natural connection between working out new comedy material and the scientific method.
There's very much a scientific method in the joke writing process. Back to the drawing board. Okay, have to try this experiment with this. You know, recreating experiments in different environments. I mean, that's really... Comedy is a nonstop calibration process. There are ways to make things work. Maybe you just have to figure it out through experimentation.
For Neil deGrasse Tyson, mixing science and comedy has been a successful experiment. His appearances on shows like The Colbert Report and his ease with scientific language have set him up to fill the shoes of the late Carl Sagan. Tyson is due to begin production on a new version of Cosmos soon. For him, comedy is a necessary ingredient.
I think comedy, when done well, belongs everywhere. As you walk through your day, if you're scientifically literate, the world looks very different to you. It's no longer mysterious. It is knowable. And that's empowering for anyone.
Tyson, along with Bill Nye the Science Guy, is about to start releasing videos on a YouTube channel connected to Chris Hardwick's Nerdist Industries. In the meantime, if you like learning with a laugh, you can always download a podcast on your phone or go online. Or, depending on where you are, it could be worth checking out the schedule at your local bar. Daisy Rosario, New York City.
Now we're joined by storyteller Jeff Zimmerman. Jeff is the man behind the stage show And I Am Not Lying. It's a show that mixes live first-person storytelling, sideshow, burlesque, and comedy. The show is named for a blog Jeff started while living with his parents and struggling to get by. Jeff's show was part of this year's South by Southwest Interactive Festival in Austin, Texas, and will be playing soon in Washington, D.C. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, glad to do it, man.
So, Jeff, you started the blog that is the namesake for your show while working some lame jobs. What was the first bad job you had?
Oh, man. I can't even actually remember the first bad job I had, but every job you have until you're like 30 is a bad job. But I don't trust anybody that hasn't had a bad job. But the really notable worst job I ever had is I was actually uh, I'd majored in art, and I was sitting around my parents' house waiting on that lucrative career in art to just fall into my lap. And then it sort of did. I was applying to be an art teacher at a bunch of museums and stuff. And then this lady called me up and she said, hey, we've got this opportunity for you where you're going to star in a play if you're up for this. Are you up for this? And I didn't even know what it was. I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. Yes, I'm up for it. And she was like, good, you'll be the star in a play, a moral play that brings the magic of theater to small children. You'll be a rude gingerbread boy, and you're going to go – and there will be a moral element to it. You'll burst out of this plywood oven. You'll be chased by a fox, and you're going to bring the magic of theater to children at daycare centers in the Richmond, Virginia, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. area. What do you say? What do you think? And what I thought was, that's the stupidest freaking thing I've ever heard of. But what I said was, I'll take it. Because a job is essentially a joke that you play on the world, right? Like you get – there's different ways you play. You either maximize the spread between the money you make and the amount of actual work you do, but that wasn't going to happen to me. So what you do is you do the stupidest thing anybody has ever heard of, and every day you don't die and you continue to collect a paycheck is a day you win.
That's how you gauge it, right?
Yeah. Until you level up. And nobody knows how you level up. It's still a mystery. At first, it was amazing because I wore this adorable costume. I had these purple raisins that went down the front and a little hood with like fake icing on it that I would put on. And I would burst out of the plywood oven and all the kids would scream and I'd run as fast as I can and be chased by this huge sweaty woman in a fox costume. And the kids – at some point, I would have to hide from the fox and I would lie on the floor and the kids would cover me with their little bodies and the fox would be like, where's the gingerbread boy? And then I would have to escape. And when you have all of those kids, like a whole bunch of five-year-olds on you just like squirming with excitement, they don't know a story. You know, they really don't know what's going to happen. And they're just loving it. They're just on the ride with you. And that it just soaks. It's just a blast dripping down the back of your throat of sheer joy all day long. Like three times a day. It was astonishing. And then when I knew this girl that I was trying to rap to at a bar and she said, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I bring the magic of theater to small children and they pretty much love it. I might as well have said, I have a basket of puppies here. Would you like one? You know, so that was awesome for a minute. But then I ran into a little trouble because everybody thinks that dudes in early childhood education are secretly creeps. Like I went into all that debt just to finally get inside the hen house. And like when a kid falls down and hurts himself, you got to be very careful about hugging them. Everybody's like looking to see both hands. It sucks, you know? And being under that kind of suspicion is bad news. And then, you know, I wasn't really making a whole ton of money. The other thing is that there's no sick leave. There was no days off. There's no anything. Like you pay to, you know, you do the show, you get the check per show. And little kids are just powering up their immune systems and they're cycling through everything and their faces are just like just these constant evolving petri dishes all day long. So I got like India sick one time, just lie in the bathtub, let it happen, leave the shower on, hope you're alive in a few days, kind of sick, you know? And yeah. My pants didn't fit anymore when I got out of the tub. And wow. Just everywhere. And then I was losing out. But I calculated that if I did every single show and I ate all the poppy seed bagels and peanut butter my buddy was bringing home from his job at the bagel shop, I would like make it. But I was short on rent because I didn't do the shows and I had to come up with money. And how do you come up with money when you're on the road all the time entertaining small children, bringing them the magic of theater around the D.C., Virginia, and Maryland area? Well, the answer is quite simple. My buddy was like, you sell plasma. That's what you do. He was like, I totally found this place downtown.
So blood.
Yeah. Well, they take the stuff, they put the needles in your arms and they take it out and they run it through a centrifuge that does like this. And then it takes all the plasma is the liquid that the cells float in. So they put the blood cells back in and they keep the plasma. And that's what enables you to sell it two or three times a week.
Okay.
And he was like, you can totally sell it twice a day because this place is loosey goosey. Just go do some push-ups behind the dumpster if your pulse is low and they'll totally let you back in.
Right.
And I thought, well, this is the answer to all my problems. If that's the answer to your problems, it is not the answer to your problems. You got more problems than you're capable of seeing. So, you know, I go in there and they do a mandatory heroin test to make sure that you can give blood.
Yeah.
And I flunked the heroin test so fast. And I've never done heroin. I don't mess around like that. I don't party like that. But
poppy seed bagels or something.
Poppy seed bagels, throw it. And I'd like the Seinfeld episode. And I was like, you know, if you're going to flunk a heroin test, you should at least have enjoyed heroin. And and my mother was sick and I wanted to be able to give, you know, she's going to have some surgery. And I was just like, don't put my name in the database that says like AIDS risk, can never donate blood again. Let me just, I'll cut you a deal. I start bargaining. I'm like, I'll just walk out of here and we'll call it even Steven. And the woman was like, no, it's okay, baby. I believe you. And you don't want to hear that either, but whatever. So I'm sitting there and they're taking the blood out of my arms and they're putting it back in. And then this plasma machine is going like that. And it would spit these blood clots out up against the wall and it'd slide down. And I'd get these piles in my arms, kind of like if you people at home imagine half a golf ball sticking out of the inside of your elbow and covered in a growing bruise. And I was like, what's that? And they said, well, you're so dehydrated and you have so many lipids in your system, basically from living off a Mountain Dew and road pizza all the time, that the blood is getting backed up and it's going to be fine. You know, relative term, the word fine. And the only thing creepier than a grown man in a gingerbread suit is a grown man in a gingerbread suit with giant bruises running up and down his arms trying to entertain children. And so, like, I'm sick. I'm exhausted. I'm broken. You really start resenting the kids. And like when the kids would sell me out, when the fox would come by, I started taking that real personally because they'd always be like, he's right here. Whenever the fox would ask, they'd just roll over on me. And we had a moment and they would destroy that moment. And I was just like, oh, I'm so just so angry, seething with this rage. And I just want to kick one of them in the face. And one day I did. Mostly by accident, but like I would, I'm a large dude. I'm 6'2", about 250, and I'm in a little ball covered with toddlers, and I would kind of scoot them out of way to get a path so that I wouldn't step on their little developing fingers or whatever. But then one of them, as I'm getting up, crawled right in front of my knee, and my knee just went and hit him like MMA style right in the face, and he spins off, and like when they shoot one wing off of the TIE fighter in Star Wars, and he's just going, like that, and I've got to keep doing the play because the teacher was like, keep going, keep going. So I'm continuing to do my lines, and the kid is just going, like that, and stuff is coming out of every hole on his face. He's like the bottom of a snail, and he's right in front of me. And I was just like, and then the gingerbread went. And I started crying, and I had to cry my way through the last 10 minutes of the play. And it was over, and I just didn't even care about looking creepy. I just picked the kid up and gave him a big hug. I didn't care who saw it. And I would like to say that is when I learned that when you do something as a joke, you're also doing it for real. But it took like 10 years. So,
yeah. It's quite a story.
Thanks, man.
So yes, you're based in New York City, but you've traveled other cities. What cities have you traveled to, and where can we find you in the future?
I'm going to be in Washington. We're going to be doing the big show in Washington, D.C. at the Black Cat on Sunday, December the 9th. Black Cat's been very good to us, and we're super excited about that. And we did a show sponsored by WBUR in Boston at the Middle East. And then we were in Philadelphia this summer, and we did South by Southwest this year. And we're going to go back for South by Southwest next year. We're just kind of working out the details on that right now. Which is very exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Jeff.
No problem, dude.
Appreciated the time.
Okay, no problem. Okay.
We're taking a bit of a leap here. From the New York stage to the South Pole. You might not know this, but there are more than 140 lakes trapped under glaciers in Antarctica. And in these lakes, researchers hope to find some of the toughest and tiniest creatures known to science. Jay Raj takes us on a journey to the frozen continent, where a British team is probing the ice. There they hope to find signs of life and a record of the Earth's climate under hundreds of thousands of years of ice.
Martin Siegert is the lead scientist of the Lake Ellsworth expedition. He says researchers first confirmed there were lakes beneath Antarctica 16 years ago at a site called Lake Vostok.
The microbiological community got very excited about the potential for this place to be a habitat for life, an extreme habitat, possibly having unique living organisms, and in living in a way that's very unusual on our planet.
Lake Vostok in East Antarctica is about the size of New Jersey. It's buried beneath 4 kilometers of glacial ice. Siegert decided that Lake Ellsworth, which is a few hundred times smaller and closer to the surface in West Antarctica, was a better bet. It's easier to get to, and its smaller size means it's simpler to study than a larger lake. It's a long way to the bottom of the planet. After a flight of over 2,000 miles, the team and the equipment travel by tractor train through the Ellsworth Mountains to reach the site. And getting there is only the beginning. Siegert and his group of engineers and scientists will then have to tunnel through 2 miles of solid ice. and hundreds of thousands of years into the past.
Somehow we need to devise a system that is going to allow us to get down into the subglacial lake, to deploy the instruments that we need to, and to recover them as well, and to do all of that really cleanly, and then when we're finished, to not leave any major footprint behind.
His team will use a technique called hot water drilling.
So what we do is we melt some very clean glacier ice, and we heat it to 90 degrees centigrade, and then we pass it through a biofilter.
The process is a sophisticated version of the filters used in homes to purify tap water for drinking. Drilling through the ice will take about 5 days, and once the team has access to the lake, they'll have 24 hours to get the samples they need before the hole freezes again. It's the most ambitious hot water drilling project ever attempted. Chris Hill is the program manager for the expedition.
This is the first day that all eight of us have been on site together. And the most important job of the day is we actually find out and mark where we're going to drill down to Lake Ellsworth.
That's him at the Lake Ellsworth site, marking the spot where the team will work.
So I need to look at my map, check my coordinates, get the GPS programmed up, and then go on a little trek out into the middle of essentially nowhere and put a flag in the ground. I think we're about here.
All of the equipment will live in 8 20-foot shipping containers, including power generators, a series of pumps to control pressure, and a hose 3.5 kilometers long. The water and sediment samples the British Antarctic Survey hopes to retrieve will provide clues about minuscule life forms. This work will also help scientists understand massive shifts in climate. Robin Bell is an Antarctic researcher at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, who has coordinated 9 major expeditions studying ice sheet collapse. She says studying the continent is crucial to climate science.
You know, there was a mile of ice here over my office 20,000 years ago, and even more in upstate New York. So we know that the Earth goes between cold and hot, depending on how much solar energy is coming in and how we're tilted towards the sun. But we don't know from sediments what the atmosphere was like. And ice sheets are unique in that they actually capture ancient atmosphere.
Climate scientists measure the composition of bubbles of gas trapped in ancient sediments to form a picture of Earth's atmosphere hundreds of thousands of years ago. Understanding how the atmosphere has changed in the past will provide vital clues about how it will continue to change in the future. For now, the Lake Ellsworth team is concentrating on the present mission. After all, they've only got one shot to get it right. For Audiophiles, I'm Ajay Raj.
Sound recordings for this story were provided by the British Antarctic Survey from their archives from previous expeditions. And the audio of Chris Hill is from a video taken outside at Lake Ellsworth. You can find more online at audiofilespodcast.com. That's audiofiles with an F, all one word. The steel pan, commonly known as the steel drum, originated in the twin islands of Trinidad and Tobago in the 1930s. Notes are hammered out on 55-gallon drums and played with rubber-tipped wooden sticks. This music is the soundtrack to Trinidad's wildly popular Carnival celebration, a celebration that's also found its way to New York. Jorta Sena has this story on the city's next generation of West Indian American panists.
11-year-old Melina Scott is tired. She leans against her tenor bass pan. Her metal braces flash as she explains why she loves it.
I like the sound of what it makes. It's a really different instrument.
Scott plays in Pantonic, the neighborhood's youth steel pan orchestra. She's one of the band's youngest members, but also one of its most dedicated.
I wake up very early, just doing things, and then I come here and then spend a long time here. I just think that the more I do, the better I can become and stuff. You get smarter when you do more things, so the more things I do, I know the smarter I'll get.
It's a frigid night in Brooklyn's Canarsie neighborhood. But here in the basement of a tax service business on Flatlands Avenue, things are just warming up.
Okay, let's try it again, please. Same spot. One, just up.
That's Wayne Bernard, the band's instructor. He holds rehearsals in this crowded space every Saturday evening. Exposed plumbing hangs from the ceiling, and the room is lit by bright fluorescent lights. 1, 2, 1, 2, 8, 8, 8, 8. Keeping 24 teenage musicians focused on a Saturday night takes patience.
Wow. Let me tell you. Doing this here, I have an all new fond respect for the New York City teachers. I really do, because it's so easy for a young mind to get distracted in this day and age.
It's important that each member plays his or her steel pan in perfect unison with the others. Bernard says the band is only as strong as its weakest link, and tonight, the tenors are struggling. Bernard works them over and over until it's right.
Back at it again. La, la, da, 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 da. Take it from there.
He bands two pan sticks together to help them keep the same rhythm.
And that's what I like about Trinidad. It doesn't matter age range. It could be 8-year-old and they're disciplined. They're ready, you know. Knock the pan once, they understand what that means. They stop. There's no talking, there's no coasting, there's no nothing.
The high-pitched drums are especially dissonant. It's Bernard's strict lessons that create harmony from different pitches.
This is a tenor pan. I play double seconds. It's cello.
Tenor bass.
It's a six bass.
Most members of Pantonic are first-generation Americans. Their parents come from West Indian nations like Trinidad and Tobago, Jamaica, and Grenada. Bernard says many of their fathers and mothers played the pan growing up, and they want to pass this tradition on to their children. Melina Scott's mother, Beverly Scott, is a piano teacher who moved here from Guyana 25 years ago.
I ordered her a tenor pan so she could have at home. Because I live here in New York, and she's an American, born American, and she hasn't been back to Guyana. And she wouldn't know anything about the culture. Helps to keep the culture alive.
So I have friends and family that are from Trinidad, and they, like, pan is everywhere for them. If you don't know pan, you're kind of crazy if you're in Trinidad.
Students like Melina are highly sought after. Like football teams at a draft, steel pan bands hope to snag the most talented musicians and develop them over time. The Super Bowl for these bands is called Panorama. The event is molded after the competition of the same name in Trinidad. In New York, the event takes place during the annual West Indian Day Parade. The city's top groups compete for trophies and cash. For Bernard, prizes come second to teaching.
I'm not personally getting paid for this, and that's fine by me. I do it for the love. When I was coming up, someone took that same time out to teach me. It's not a problem for us to take our time out of our lives to pass on the culture. And that's what we're trying to promote, and that's what we're looking for. That
he hopes students like Melina Scott will one day do the same. Jota Sena, Kanasi, Brooklyn.
You're listening to Audio Files. We'll be back in a moment.
Hi, I'm Dean Castronovo.
Hi, I'm Steve Algieri.
And I'm Jonathan Cain.
And I'm Ross Valerie of Journey for recording artists, actors, and athletes against drunk driving. After we do a show and when we've been partying, we have a designated driver waiting for us in the bus.
So when you decide to party, make sure you do too.
Designated driver or be a designated driver.
Because drinking and driving just don't mix.
A public service announcement brought to you by RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
I want to finish and then go to be able to and have my parents couldn't have. I'll even make because I know It's the best thing I can do for my... I want to finish
school
and then go to
college
to be able to
graduate
and have
the future
my parents couldn't have. I'll even make
sacrifices
because I know that
going to college
is the best thing I can do for my
future.
It takes the words of a parent to build the future of a child. The Hispanic Scholarship Fund has the tools and information to help your kids go to college. It's free and it's available in Spanish. Remember, their tomorrow depends on your words today. Visit yourwordstoday.org or call 1-877-HSF-8711. Sponsored by the Hispanic Scholarship Fund and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. You're listening to Audio Files. I'm your host, Adam Warner. A few summers ago, Jeannie Ferrari saw a flyer in her yoga studio. It advertised a program that would bring mindfulness and yoga classes into city public schools. Now Jeannie is the principal of the Humanities Preparatory Academy in Chelsea, and she's incorporated this mindfulness program into her school's curriculum. Audio Files' Christine Strike went to a class and brought back this postcard.
Close your eyes. Connect with the breath.
My name is Dennis Teston.
Inhale.
My job here is a yoga teacher, mindfulness practices with the Lineage Project.
And exhale. Today I want to talk about the idea of integrity. Anybody offer me a quick definition of integrity?
Me.
Rachel.
Doing the right thing even when nobody else is looking.
Ah, interesting, yeah.
My name is Beth Navon. My title is Executive Director of the Lineage Project. The objective of the Lineage Project has been to offer these mindfulness practices to young people who are either incarcerated or at risk of incarceration.
So the idea of integrity as responsibility.
You're at risk if you live in a neighborhood where there's violence, if you've seen family members, friends killed, if you've seen parents' generation or aunts, uncles, cousins incarcerated. That's at risk to us.
Name a situation where you were able to take responsibility for your actions, even if that meant getting into trouble. Ray.
Last year, we were taking like a test in my class, and I asked this kid for like help on one of the questions, and then he ended up getting in trouble for it. And in the end, I just like said that it was my fault, but I felt good knowing that I was honest about it.
I think like all of us, they thrive on respect, and they crave it, and listening. Listening and mindfully listening, not just allowing them to have the stage and talk, but really listen and comment on what they're saying and ask questions.
My name is Jeannie Ferrari. I'm the interim acting principal of Humanities Preparatory Academy. I think that having mindfulness permeating our culture is a way for students to connect with each other, to step back and know when they're hurting someone, to practice being more compassionate with each other, to be able to improve their own relationships and to communicate with people in a way that feels healthy.
Let's start to move through the body here.
Mindfulness for anyone quiets the mind, and we then have the opportunity to become more creative, listen, focus. For a high school student, the practice really allows them, even if it's only for that 60 minutes that they're in class, to really take time for themselves.
Go ahead and reach your arms overhead and stretch from finger to toe. So today, when you leave, think about that idea of taking responsibility. Hands together at your heart. Namaste.
Namaste.
New York City's Midtown is one of the most vibrant places on the planet. But just across the East River is a toxic waste site. Newtown Creek is so polluted from decades of industrial waste and sewage that the United States Environmental Protection Agency has labeled it a Superfund site. But despite its disgusting condition, Newtown Creek has been getting more and more attention from artists who have used this and other contaminated sites for their photography, film, and public art installations. Reporter Eli Chen went to find out what's attracting artists to these filthy waterways.
It's a Saturday afternoon in late September, and there are about 20 people strolling along the banks near the Newtown Creek wastewater treatment plant. They've all come to see a fleet of remote-controlled boats that are swirling haphazardly in the water. The boats are a part of a public art installation called the Newtown Creek Armada. The banks of the creek are lined with old factories and landfill, but this doesn't seem to keep Greenpoint resident Brian Davis from enjoying the event. He's piloting one of the boats up and down the murky waterway.
I'm the sewage digester boat. I started with the nature boat, and my friend let me drive this one because it's faster.
Each boat has a camera tucked beneath it to film the underwater life of Newtown Creek. That sound comes from footage of one of the Newtown Creek's tributaries, Dutch Kills. It's playing on a video feed installed inside a large pipe protruding from the ground. Newtown Creek is a 3.5-mile waterway nestled between Brooklyn and Queens. It's one of two federal Superfund sites in New York City. The other is the Gowanus Canal, further south in Brooklyn. Both of these waterways have a lot in common. They both are desolate industrial waterfronts with sizable landfills. They both have toxic carcinogenic waste in the water, and they both draw a growing number of artists who are using them as a source of inspiration.
It is still beautiful, you know, as a body of water, despite all the horror stories.
Sasha Chavchavadze is the founding director of the Proteus Gowanus, an art gallery located less than a block from the canal. She says the reason some artists are drawn to places like the Gowanus Canal is because they're complicated. She says that artists are interested in going to unknown territory and reshaping the way we see our environments. One artist did this by building a device that combines 3D images of the canal with sounds from under the Union Street Bridge. Creator Kevin Allen calls it the Gowanus Phonoscope.
It's a word that I invented, but you know, the Greek roots, phono and scope, is sound and vision, so it's a, to me, it's a way to describe seeing through hearing.
Using underwater microphones, Allen recorded motorboats, faraway sirens, and gurgling noises from an unidentifiable creature he calls the Gowanus Monster. He says the point of the phonoscope was to get people to listen more to their environments.
They're sort of absorbed with being plugged into things so much that we don't plug ourselves into what's around us.
This is what a lot of Superfund artwork is trying to accomplish, getting people to feel more engaged with these neglected spaces. So naturally, environmentalists find the artwork encouraging because this engagement helps their cause. John Verlin is an attorney for Riverkeeper, an organization that stewards the waterways of New York City and the Hudson River Valley.
I mean, all that stuff really helps raise awareness and really helps drive the cleanup. And, you know, honestly, it also helps involve other members of the community. You know, when people can go out and see some of these art installations and some of these projects, I think it helps with people having more of an ownership stake in the cleanup.
Riverkeeper also helps artists develop their projects. They recently helped artist Jenny Whiteman collect mud and water samples from multiple city waterways. She put them into frames to create what she calls bacteria paint.
You know, bacteria are basically the first life on the planet, and they can live in all kinds of ecosystems. And they're very clever. They're artists, right?
Jenny's paintings are almost like petri dishes that are hanging on walls.
That's Sarah Christman. She's working on an abstract film to interpret Whiteman's project.
I'm shooting very close, and so what I'd like to do is create a very immersive sensory experience for the viewers.
Christman shot time-lapse footage from various points along the canal. She'll combine these to create a moving portrait of the Gowanus. Whiteman's project focuses more on color. Each bacteria sample she collected formed unique pigments over a couple months. Christman says the Gowanus' color is especially surprising.
It's red. It's like gory, gory red. It looks like a slaughter. It looks like raw meat in a way, doesn't it?
Or red velvet,
or red
if you
velvet.
Want to take it a different way.
Whiteman says that art is a way for her to turn what we think is negative into something positive.
It's a coping mechanism because, I mean, in Newtown Creek, there are chicken plants where they're putting blood and feathers in the water, right? I mean, my paintings are beautiful because they're quite beautiful, and they happen to be happening in a very, what we as humans would call polluted site. And to me, that's hopeful. And it also means that we can do something different with this site.
Whether these artists are creating paintings, soundscapes, or remote-controlled boats, the thing that all of these Superfund-inspired pieces have in common is that they're trying to bring people closer to the water. But when it comes to whether it can change the way people treat the environment, the artists want to leave that up to interpretation. From Brooklyn, this is Eli Chen.
I'm here in the studio with guitarist Rory Cregan and Dave Delaney, bassist Kenny Dixon, and drummer Tommy Walsh. They're four of the members of the band Slack Tide. The band is really big over on Long Island. They're known for their energetic live shows. Sometimes they play eight-hour sets to jam-packed crowds. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you
for having us.
So I understand you met under unusual circumstances. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. Rory and I actually met down in Long Beach. We actually met in the hospital together back in, 2005?
The way most bands start.
Right. I was actually in the hospital. I had a broken collarbone from a surfing injury, and Rory was in there with a dislocated shoulder from a beach volleyball injury. Mm-hmm. And we just spoke about, music, and we realized we both played, and joked about how we were going to start a band at some point, and we actually did. A couple years later, Rory ended up actually moving into my sister's first floor, two-family house.
It's not a basement, it's first floor.
That's right. we ended up picking up Kenny and Tommy and our other keyboardist, Dave Lynch, along the way. And, that's it.
It came together. And so tell me about the name, too, because not everyone's from a beach community. What is the slack tide?
The slack tide is you have the high tide and the low tide, and that's the time in the middle where not much is going on. But the name came up, it's ironic because Hurricane Sandy just came out and wiped out a lot of Long Beach community. But that also happened a year ago with Hurricane Irene, and I was living on the basement first floor of his sister's place, and we were there cleaning up all the rubble and whatever. And we see all these people come by on paddleboards in the slack tide, and his brother-in-law says, "Oh, hey, let's just enjoy the slack tide for a little bit while everybody else is cleaning up the garbage." And I saw Dave at the bar about 10 minutes later, and we said, "That's the name for our band. That's what we're going to do." That's it.
So why don't we hear a song? What are you guys thinking for the...
Start with Change.
All right, we're going to play a song called Change.
It's been like this for a couple of days. If I'm gonna change my ways, maybe I'm not the man for you. But after a couple of beers, and maybe a shot, I'll do just what you want me to. I don't quite remember all the rest of the night. I don't get too worried, cause I came out alright. If I did anything strange, you don't need to tell me about it. Cause you need something to keep to yourself, and darling, I'll do all that's fine without it. It's easy to say, it's harder to do. Go and change my way, or just not hang around you. Oh Lord, I'm leaving. I seen you walking like your back is in flame. Ever since we're growing up, you haven't been the same. If I could, I would bury all your troubles in the ground. your paint is capping. Get that can call, let's paint that top. It's easy to say, it's harder to do. Go and change your ways, or just not hang around you. Oh Lord, I'm leaving.
That was great, guys. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's the first acoustic slack tide ever.
So, yep.
Ever.
It's a big experiment for us, and still an experiment.
History here tonight. So going back to Long Island, how does that sound come through in your music? Do you see the place where you come from as influencing it in any way?
Yeah. I mean, you know, on Long Island, it's way more laid back, kind of where we came from, and we would play at bars, and it was a lot of our friends for so many years. And, you know, I think it feels like a little bit more of a party than it does.
You might get hit with a bottle at any time.
Right. Whereas in the city, you know, it feels like more of a performance. You know, when you're at these venues on the Lower East Side, there's lights in your face, and you just kind of feel like you're playing a show, whereas on Long Island, it's a very, very chill vibe down in Long Beach, and I think that kind of seeped into our music.
And so does the audience change, too? Do you get different vibes from them, depending on where you're playing?
Do we?
No, you do.
Yeah. You know, it's a lot of our same friends and fans down in Long Beach as it is in the city. I'd say it's pretty similar. It's nice in the city because we get a lot of fans that might be seeing us for the first time. So I guess you kind of feel like you have to work a little bit harder sometimes.
Okay, well, let's hear another song. Which one is this going to be?
Bigger Love.
Let's hit it.
Why don't you tell them what this song's about real fast, Rory?
It's about the two machines that built the channel.
What the fuck is a
channel? What's that? Which channel is this?
The one from England to France. I always get the facts wrong, so I try and stay away from them. But they built two machines to dig it, and they both started from opposite sides, and they never met each other. And when they finally met in the middle, they decided it was cheaper to bury them in the side of the tunnel than take them back out. And it just seems like, I don't know, the great love robot story of our generation.
Definitely.
Well, here it is.
On his papa's shorts, raised above his mama's parts, oil pumping engine heart. He used to get his washings every night after digging it up, digging it up. Lord knows it wasn't right. It was never enough, and it was never enough. Said it got down, but you know it couldn't take it no way. They just wanna get it on. They just wanna get it on. Know about a bigger love. They just wanna get it on. Get it on, yeah. She was just another girl, raised up in another world. Cigarettes and movie screens, and another channel in between. She used to get her washings every night after digging it up, digging it up. Lord knows she couldn't fight it. It was never enough, and it was never enough. Said it got down, but to know she couldn't take it no way. She just wanna get it on. She just wanna get it on. bigger love, charging through the other stuff, throwing it like a ninja star, oil pumping engine high. They used to get their washings every night, after digging it up. Lord knows she couldn't fight. It was never enough, it never could be enough. And that goddamn thing never took it no way. They just wanna get it on. They just wanna get it on. Know about a bigger love. They just wanna get it on. Get it on, yeah, 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 yeah.
That was awesome, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
Maybe the only song ever written about the Channel.
As far as we know. As far as we know. Well, now it's on the radio. There's going to be a whole record of them.
So a reviewer wrote that you're a long overdue carefree band with an anti-hipster feel. And it looks like you're actually having fun performing. So how's your attitude different from other bands out there in New York?
Well, I think, you know, after years of playing in Long Beach and starting out down there and playing with our friends, you know, it was just such a carefree attitude. And, you know, again, we'd be playing like 6-8 hour sets. All of our friends would be there. We'd be inviting them up to sing.
A lot of alcohol.
Right. We'd be inviting them up to sing. And, you know, it just felt like kind of a party. And so when we made the transition into New York City, we decided we weren't going to lose that attitude and keep it fun. And it's really the only way we know how to do things. And, you know, if that doesn't make us look professional when one of our friends jumps up on stage and that, you know, ends up stopping us somehow, so be it. But that's just how we do it. So
cool. We have time for one last song. So what will the finale be tonight?
A song called Bedpost.
This is the hit. So like turn it up in your car. Your face, is it true? I know I haven't seen you around. Heard a rumor that you might be thinking about leaving town, but humor me and tell me that it isn't true, cause I don't wanna find out how to get down without you. I heard you walked up the stairs, locked all the doors. Everyone was wondering what you're lying there for. Plus there's something rattling inside your head, like how we gonna get you out of bed, cause you behind your bed for this. Creeping in your window. You've been trying to keep it simple, but I've been banging on the cymbals. You keep begging just another minute. Don't worry about the record, just learn how to spin it. Da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da. I wish
said I could hang around the rest of the week, but I got some things I gotta do to get back on my feet. And stop by the bar to see how things were going. I asked her how you are, but nobody seems to know. And they sent well wishes and dishes of food, sent me with some movies and some bottles of booze, cause I heard you walked upstairs, locked all the doors. Everyone was wondering what you're lying there for. Must have something rattling inside your head, like how we gonna get you out of bed, cause you behind your bedboards, the sunlight creeping in your windows. You've been trying to keep it simple, but I've been banging on your cymbals. Keep banging just another minute, don't worry about the record, just learn how to spin it. Da 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 da. Your bedpost, sunlight creeping in your windows. You've been trying to keep it simple, but I've been banging on your cymbals. Keep banging just another minute, don't worry about the record, just learn how to spin it. Da 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 da.
That was great, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for bringing the sounds of Long Island out to Manhattan.
Ah, pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us.
Oh, and you can check us out Plugged In December 6th at Don Pedro in Brooklyn. Woo!
Great. Check them out.
Plug.
That's right.
Today we've explored the fascinating world of art and science. If you like the podcast, be sure to check out our website at audiofilespodcast.com. That's audiofiles, all one word, with an F. Our producer is Daisy Rosario, and our assistant producer is Rachel Sapin. Sean Carlson is our online producer, and we have production help from Willis Arnold and Althea Chang. Our audio engineer is Chad Bernhardt. Thanks for joining us today. Coming to you live from the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, this is Audiophiles. I'm Adam Warner.
Rolling in some cigar and no leather gripping shit. I handle my business, so I think I deserve it.
Hey! Hey!
Hey, 16-5 a piece, nigga, USDA.